Must be 6:58, thought Goodwin. He caught the silver ball with a flipper, and the machine went silent. Greetings, folks. How you doing? This is Keith Tollier, your volunteer broadcaster. Thank you for tuning in to the Mystery Hour, right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am blessed to have you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Jim Fusilli bring us our first story, called Goody and the Bishop. Denny Goodwin went to Fathead's for its pinball machine. Nags, it was called, a horse racing theme. Pump in a nickel, send the ball flying, hit a bumper, and one of the six little cardboard horses up in the back box inched ahead. The horses had names. Real George, Dreamboat, Stinky, Bashful Flippy, and Glamorous Puss. And if the one the machine assigned Goodwin crossed the finish line first, he won a free game. You'd think it would be a snap, given that all he had to do was catch the ball with the white flipper and send it at the bumper with the horse's number on it. But no. A wheel with six bumpers in the center of the play field rotated at random, and sometimes the machine would change his horse mid-race, more often than not giving him one running in the back of the pack. Nonetheless, Goodwin, honey-haired, slouchy, and often slack-jawed, could make a quarter last a couple of hours. He was the only person in Fathead's who got his money's worth out of his extracurricular activity. The bar was a hangout for small-time gamblers who played the numbers, wagered on the races at the Meadowlands, Belmont, and the Big A, bet on any and every sporting event, and so on. By the end of the night, they'd throw down on whether the cockroach walking across the bar would make it as far as the waitress station or veer off where Henry Moo Moo, Benny Kincaid, and the other Busby were seated. Goodwin declined to participate. After a day of delivering blocks of cold cuts and cheese to delis throughout Bergen County, he sought refuge. At Fathead's, he'd order a Schlitz and report directly to Nags, which had been stationed next to the men's room since Goodwin was 8 years old, long ago now, and his father gave him a nickel to shut him up. These days, nobody would bother him for the next few hours except when the bishop came on the radio. As engaging as it could be, Nags didn't require Goodwin's entire attention. Often, he considered his options as he played. Even before he inherited the refrigerated truck and route when his father was run over by a bus on Railroad Avenue, he was thinking about how to get out of Hackensack. A trade school, maybe. A technician of some sort. Once, when an electrical short shut down Nags, Goodwin told the original Busby he'd take care of it. Popping open the cabinet, Moo Moo looking at his toolbox like it was the Ark of the Covenant, he saved the bartender a service call to the Williams Manufacturing Company way out in Chicago. Goodwin decided once he plumped a nest egg, he'd be on his way, which at this rate would be in about 10 years, since he now had to pay a mortgage on the house his father refinanced something like 6 times. "Gwaddy, now," said the original. "Be quiet for the bishop." Goodwin didn't reply. Glamour Puss was coming up on the rail. "Gwaddy," the original shouted, slapping the bar. "Must be 6:58, thought Goodwin. He caught the silver ball with a flipper, and the machine went silent, though the lights kept flashing. Everyone in Fathead's stared at the musty old Emerson radio next to the cash register. The bishop was pastor of the African New Zion United Church in East Newark, New Jersey. Every weeknight at 7 p.m., he gave a 5-minute sermon on a station dedicated to public service that had little relevance in Hackensack, except to the guys in Fathead's who believed the chapter and verse he quoted was a clue to tomorrow's number. If the bishop cited Romans 12:2, they bet 122. Corinthians 6:19, they bet 619. Exodus 8:20, they bet a 20. And so on. The bishop, an African-American man with a deep, sonorous voice, gave no indication he was up to any sort of no good. In fact, Kincaid said the bishop's biblical selections advised clean living. But he and his fellow gamblers believed the bishop was sending a nightly message to them. After all, didn't Mumu hit on Timothy 6:10 last August? The radio crackled as the original turned the dial. Almost immediately, somber organ music came forth. The men waited for the bishop's familiar greetings, "Glory be, brothers and sisters." Instead, another man spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen, we regret to inform you that tonight there will be no sermon broadcast from the Africa New Zion United Church." Alarmed, the men at the bar spun and stared at each other. The announcer continued, "The bishop asks for your prayers as he recovers from what he describes as a minor malady. We will keep you up to date regarding his progress." "Ain't they busted him," said Mumu as the announcement ended and the organ music continued. "Nah," Benny Kincaid said, "that would be news." "Minor malady," said the other busby, "the flu maybe." The original snapped off the radio. "Think they made an announcement like that if he got the flu?" he said. "He's sick. He's in the hospital probably." Goodwin, who would usually be playing the next ball by now, eavesdropped on this discussion. "Well, maybe he's dying," said Mumu. "Eh, could be," Kincaid agreed. "This is no good," the original muttered. What he didn't say, if the bishop was out of action and the guys didn't bet his numbers, he'd be short when the crew came to collect. "Gwaddy," he shouted, "over here." Intrigued, Goodwin let the silver ball drop. By the time he arrived at the bar, his work boots squeaking on the faded linoleum, the original had placed the black rotary phone in front of an empty stool. "Call the station," he instructed. "Find out what hospital." Goodwood pointed over his shoulder. "Hey, I'm in the middle of a game." "Pinball ain't going anywhere," the original barked. "Dial, get his room number." The radio station was not forthcoming. No one answered at the African New Zion United Church. Kincaid suggested Goody call hospitals in and around Newark. Eager to get back to Nags, Goodwin said, "Hey, I'm running up a phone bill over here." "Never mind that," the original told him. "Find the bishop." There were a surprising number of hospitals in and around East Newark, but on the fourth try, Goodwin struck gold. Mumu rubbed his hands together in glee. Goodwin waited as the switchboard operator transferred him. He figured he'd tell the nurse he wanted to send flowers and she'd give up the number. Then he'd get back to Nags. He heard a click. "Hello," said a tired voice, a man's tired voice. "The bishop's." Goodwin stammered. Is that you, Bishop?" All of Fathead's inched toward him. "And you are?" said the bishop. Goodwin thought as fast as he could. I listened to your sermons, Bishop. I'm a little worried." "That is kind of you to say," the bishop intoned. "What's the diagnosis?" The original frowned and mouthed, "Room number." "Kidney stones, I'm afraid." "Oh, ouch," said Goodwin. "Indeed." "Well, we're big fans, Bishop, and we're rooting for you." "Bless your kind soul, son." The other was gesturing for Goody to hurry up. His need to place a bet was overwhelming him. Would you mind, Bishop, if I asked what room you're in?" The bishop said, "Well, I'm in a ward. I don't recall if it had its own number." "Ah, they should give you a private room," Goodwin said. "But I think I know why you're calling." "You do? Mind if I ask? You're white, aren't you?" Goodwin said he was. "And enterprising?" "I am," he he replied boldly. Doing what? I deliver things. Now even Benny Kincaid was annoyed. I'll tell you what, young man, why not pay me a visit tomorrow? I think I'd like to meet you. Say hello. For some unknown reason, Goodwin said, Okay, Bishop. Fine, meanwhile, tell your friends it's Philippians 4:19. Got it. You know, to keep our conversation on the down low, right? Yes, I do, Bishop. Then until tomorrow. 4:19, Goodwin said as he returned the phone to the original. Mumu slapped down a $5 bill, a larger than usual wager. Not willing to be outdone, the other upped his bet. Benny Kincaid opened his wallet. If 4:19 hits, I'm screwed, thought the original. Stepping lightly, suppressing a smile, Goodwin went back to Nags, though not before telling the original busby he owed him a nickel. He parked his refrigerator truck across from the hospital and, bright bouquet of flowers in hand, trotted across the busy four-lane throughfare. At reception, he was greeted with little interest, then set to the eighth floor. As he had been the only white guy in the lobby, he was the only white guy in the elevator. Ma'am, he said to the stout woman riding up alongside him. The nurse's aide nodded politely. She was carrying a caddy of blood samples. As he approached the ward, he paused, tugged on the bottom of his blazer, checked the crease in his slacks, ran his fingers through his hair. Peeking in, he saw three African-American men in various stages of health, in their beds, under blankets, and in hospital gowns. Machines beeped and booped. To the first man on his right, he said, Bishop? Though fluids were dripping into both bony arms, he pointed a long finger to the far corner of the room, where a curtain had been pulled to conceal the fourth patient. Thank you, said Goodwin, who rattled with nerves. On the ride over, he renewed his possibilities. He had been considered overnight in his bed in Hackensack. He opened the thin curtain. A plump, robust man with close-cropped hair and a goatee was propped up in his bed, a burgundy and gold shawl over his shoulders. On his overbed table was an open Bible, a yellow legal pad, and a gold cross pen. He wore a thin gold wristwatch. Bishop? Yes, he replied dubiously. Stepping forward, Goodwin extended his arm. He said, for you. Well, aren't you considerate? Put them in that carafe, would you? Goodwin did as he was instructed. They call you Goody, sir. You're a working man. Yes, sir. You do all right. I like to work, he admitted. Delivering, though, he shrugged, I'm surviving. Survival is not the point, Goody. The bishop grimaced as he shifted in his bed. You've heard it said, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Where's that, Bishop? Ecclesiastes 9:7. God wants us to be happy, not just getting by. Goodwin knew the guys at Fatheads would double their bets, 097 and 970. The bishop said, there's an assignment that needs someone just like you. You know Newark? Well, I've got a map. Someone on the other side of the curtain began hacking and phlegming so furiously that Goodwin thought he might heave up a lung. Does that every now and then, the bishop confided with a wink. Needs attention. An assignment? The bishop scribbled on his legal pad. Get yourself over to the 7th Ward, near St. Lucie's. There's a storefront. You can't miss it. They fly an Italian flag. Goodwin was listening. You walk in, and you tell them I sent you. You return envelope in hand. That's it? He tore off a corner of the yellow sheet. Give me your driver's license. Goodwin hesitated. You'll get it back unless you disappear. Oh, I won't. License? The bishop said, reaching out. As if in a trade, he gave Goodwin the slip of paper. On it he'd written, "He's okay," and signed it with a flourish. "What if I get pulled over?" "Little chance, white guy," he said. Goodwin returned, now calm as a summer breeze. 20 minutes, the bishop observed.
They don't chat, those guys."
The Italian guy who intercepted him at the door looked like Jabba the Hutt in a yellow velour tracksuit. He put the envelope on the table. "How much?" the bishop asked.
"I didn't look,"
an indignant Goodwin replied. $514. The bishop dipped in and produced a $20 bill. $1 a minute," he said as he passed it to Goodwin. "Worth coming down every few nights from Kaplan Avenue in Hackensack?" Goodwin took back his wallet.
"Well, time is money too, Bishop. It's an hour road trip, but if I can help you..."
"Yeah, sure."
"It'll be worth your while, son." Goodwin was told to return the day after tomorrow. But call first. Maybe he'd have to report to the radio station rather than the hospital. The bishop wrote down the station's address.
"One thing, though," Goodwin said. "Maybe pay for the turnpike."
The bishop gave him an extra 10. In the lobby, Goodwin called Fathead's collect.
"You ready?" he said to the original.
"Go."
"Let's agree I get 5% on the overage, okay?"
"What?"
the original snapped.
"You're crack, Goody."
"Shh. Don't let nobody know. You'd be a dope to pass this up."
Goodwin could see it. The original was carrying the phone to a corner, the cord slapping behind him. Now came a whisper.
"You're strong-arming me, Goody. What would your old man say?"
"He would say, 'When did you get those brains, Denny?'"
This is straight from the bishop's mouth.
With a sigh, the original said,
"Well, all right, but you better be..."
Goodwin rattled off a series of numbers. 097-970-514. Then he threw in the hospital ward number, 806.
"And this you got from the bishop?"
"Absolutely. So, 5 points, and the pinball is free."
The original pulled the phone away from his face. He shouted,
"Goody's with the bishop. You ready?"
"Ready,"
replied the gambler's choir. Some weeks it was 3 times, others twice, once during Thanksgiving week and around Christmas. It was routine now. In fact, Goodwin didn't even have to get out of the van. Jabba waddled over with the envelope. He looked surprised when Goodwin said, "Happy New Year." Then he went, "Yeah, you too." The bishop threw him $100 as a holiday bonus. In turn, Goodwin bought a half dozen Hess toy fire trucks and brought them to the African New Zion United Church to give out to the kids. While he was there, he fixed its pantry cabinets and snaked a clogged drain. By now, Goodwin had $1,700 in the bottom of his toolbox. He noticed the amount in the envelope the Italians gave him always differed. Some Tuesdays it was $613, others $491, or $567. Piece of cake for Goodwin to skim 50 or 60 bucks from the take. Since he was the intermediary, who on either side would know? Meanwhile, back at Fathead's, the original came across. 5% on what was above the usual weekly total when 3 guys at the bar were wagering about $1 each on the numbers per night. Now, maybe 25 people were at the bar when the bishop did his nightly broadcast, betting anywhere from a couple of quarters to $5. When Mumu's wife hit on 888, Goodwin had remembered the street address of the radio station. The population swelled further. From his spot at the pinball machine, Goodwin watched as the crowd went silent, and the bishop, who, out of a hospital bed, favored 3-piece suits and pork pie hats, began his sermon. Bills and coins were slapped on the bar soon thereafter. The bishop called the Italians to complain.
but they wouldn't talk on the phone, nor would they meet at St. Lucie's, well aware of any plan requiring their intervention would need to be made out of God's earshot. The bishop was seated in the busy Greyhound waiting room at Newark Penn Station when Vito Salt alla Marina arrived, accompanied by two refrigerator-sized guards. A handsome man with a pencil mustache, Don Vito was the local capo. The bishop felt the air change as he rose to greet him.
"You got a complaint," Don Vito said, getting right to it.
"The weekly payout," said the bishop, who wore a blue mink coat and a matching fedora. "It's light." Don Vito snapped his fingers, and Refrigerator 2 handed him a slip of paper. He glanced at it and passed it to the bishop. In one column were dates since Goodwin began collecting. In the other, the sum of money he received. The bishop scanned the list.
"No," he said. "With respect, this is not what I'm getting. The last few weeks? Maybe half."
"Hmm," said Don Vito, who then departed with Refrigerator 1. The bishop frowned and said, "That's it? That's how we do business all these years, and he walks away?"
"Hey, shut it," Refrigerator 2 explained. "Everything you know, give."
"But like what?" He waved the little sheet of paper. "Like how my cut is disappearing? You people know I do more business for you than the dream book." The crew published a pamphlet that attributed a 3-digit number to this or that dream. Some guy in Chinatown cooked up the scheme.
"I bring you all sorts of folks, colored and white, from all over New York, even you."
Refrigerator 2 put his mammoth foot on top of the bishop's patent leather shoe and, with an icy glare, began to press.
"Everything on the delivery guy. Give."
Hissing and grimacing, he spit out Goodwin's home address in Hackensack. Refrigerator 2 stepped back. Announcements for buses heading yon and hither, hither and yon, crackled overhead. As his pain fled, the bishop raised up in anger. He had about enough of these immigrants.
"You should choose carefully how you muscle, Dumbo," he said.
He opened his mink to reveal a pearl handle, 44 Magnum in a shoulder holster. Refrigerator 2 unbuttoned his long leather coat and showed the bishop he carried a shotgun along one flank and a sledgehammer along the other. The bishop said,
"I get what's mine. That's all I ask."
"Get it from Goodwin," said number 2, walking away.
Maltreated and insulted, the bishop sought composure and found it as he strode along Market Street, the January wind brushing his cheeks and cooling his temper. For the long game, he needed the Italians, not Goodwin. Don Vito needed the bishop and his radio broadcast. The bishop figured he wouldn't get back the funds Goodwin stole, but that was all right. When the cops found Goodwin hanging from a lamppost, he'd spread the word in the community that the Italians exacted revenge on his behalf. He flagged a cab. "The African New Zion United Church," he told the driver, a white man with an eye chart for a last name.
"Say that again," requested Andrushku Wurzenkowiczkowitz.
"The African New Zion United Church." The driver pumped the meter and looked into the rear view.
You're the bishop, aren't you? I know that voice anywhere."
Dignity restored, the bishop patted the man on his shoulder and blessed him with a smile, figuring he'd at least ride for free. Perplexed, the refrigerators were straining the floorboards on the porch of Goodwin's house when a crotchety woman, walking a Scotty in a tartan coat, stopped to stare at them.
"Who are you?" she demanded.
"Jehovah's Witness," replied Refrigerator 1.
"He's at Fathead's," she pointed that away. "Him and his darn pinball."
But when the refrigerators drove their black Cadillac Eldorado to Fathead's, they found
Nags, unoccupied, and about 20 men at the bar, staring at an old radio.
Hey, just a minute, fellas, said the original.
Refrigerator 2 removed the 20-pound sledgehammer from under his coat.
Where's Goodwin?
Number 1 asked, just as the bishop came on the air.
Hey, will you shut it?
Henry Mumu, who hadn't looked to see who was insulting him. The other Bushby blanched as Number 1 grabbed Mumu's head in his hand and lifted him off his stool. While the bishop continued to riff on Isaiah 42, Refrigerator 2 raised the sledgehammer and brought it down with full force onto the pinball machine's playfield. Glass shattered, and the game's legs gave way. Now the original had his sawed-off shotgun aimed at Refrigerator 1, who loosened his grip on Mumu's head.
"Drop the hammer, big man," the original said.
"Good one owes us 9 G's, replied Number 2, who, with sledgehammer perched on his shoulder, walked slowly toward the bar.
With little effort, he grabbed Kincaid by the collar and held him as if he were a shield. His legs dangled as Mumu's had. Dying, the pinball machine let out a few sickly chimes and moans, then collapsed on its side. With well-practiced efficiency, Number 1 reached across the bar, grabbed the original shotgun, and yanked it out of his hand.
"Pony up," he said, waving the weapon. "Everybody."
"Wait," said the other, holding up his hand as if the bishop gave them tomorrow's number. The original snapped off the radio.
Now, if we had 9 G's...
Refrigerator 2 took Kincaid and shook him like a rag doll.
"Whatever you got, give."
Though his temples throbbed, Mumu volunteered to collect the cash. $182, including the rolls of coins in the cash register.
"Tell Goodwin he makes good or we start breaking ankles," Number 1 said.
"He's gone," said Kincaid as he tumbled to the floor.
Looking up from the linoleum littered with cigarette butts, he said,
"3 days he's not here. He can't live without the game. Snow up to your pockets and he comes in and plays Christmas Eve, New Year's Day. He plays. I'm telling you, fellas, Goody is gone."
"And so's your dough," the original added.
Refrigerator Number 2 scooped up the $182. With Mumu as hostage, they exited. Half an hour later, they tossed him out on Route 17. If they had pulled over to release him gently, they would have seen in the gaudy, tinseled used car lot across the highway the delivery van Goodwin traded in for a sturdy Ford Taurus. Denny Goodwin drove straight through to Chicago, so dizzy from flight was he that, as he exited Route 90, the city appeared like an apparition. The Sears Tower reaching out of the clouds down to the street below. With $7,900 in his toolbox, he found a Howard Johnson Motor Lodge, filled up the bathtub, and slept in water until it turned cold. By the time he left the inn, nighttime had arrived again. As he wandered, turning a once vague notion into a detailed plan, the wind pushed him and punished him like his old man with his belt. You'd think Goody would have looked into the weather situation before he fled west, but he didn't. As far as leaving Fatheads without a warning, he figured the original Busby was connected. Some crew, maybe the same crew that owned Newark, let him run a book out of the bar. He'd get smacked around, but since he earned, they'd go easy. Regarding the bishop, Goodwin tried to feel bad about skimming his take, but he was a gasbag who used the church as a front. Those boys and girls at the African New Zion United Church needed the funds the bishop took in more than he needed a gold pinky ring, Cuban cigars, or another case of Cavassier. Before pointing his Taurus toward Illinois, Goodwin dropped $200 in an envelope and mailed it to the church in care of the lady who helped the kids do their arithmetic homework. The next morning, in Chicago, Goodwin dressed fresh and neat. Toolbox on the passenger seat, he drove to the outskirts of town where he found the manufacturing facility of WMS Industries. Brimming with confidence, he informed the guard at the gate that he had an appointment with Human Resources, which was a lie, but so what? Once up in the HR department, he told a secretary that he was an arcade technician with a specialty that would be of particular interest to the company, formerly known as the Williams Manufacturing Company, makers of Nags, a pinball machine with a horse racing theme. Thought Goodwin as he sat waiting for his interview, Dreamboat and Bashful are running neck and neck with Flippy on the rail, and here comes Glamour Puss on the outside. Dreamboat and Glamour Puss! Dreamboat and Glamour Puss! It's Glamour Puss by a nose! Ding, ding, ding! Flashing lights, swirling pinwheels, free game! I want a free game! Okay, now to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. Joseph Goodrich brings us our next story, and it's called The Winter Visit. I wasn't there when one bright and bitterly cold December morning, Kim stopped by the old house on McMillan Street. Well, I was long gone by then, attending college in St. Paul. Kim was on shore leave. Aunt Marion said he looked quite distinguished in his trim blue uniform garrison cap, heavy woolen pea coat, and shiny black shoes. "Oh, the Navy's really straightened him out," she told me. "Who knows what would have happened otherwise?" What often happens to two boys who grow up fatherless and broke in small-town America? They get into trouble, sometimes pretty bad trouble. Some of them are lucky enough to find an advocate who says, "You matter," a teacher who recognizes a child's potential, a neighbor who serves as a role model. My aunt did what she could to make Kim feel accepted and appreciated, but there was only so much she could do. She had her hands full with me. When I knew him best, Kim and his mother lived in a cramped, rented house near the drive-in movie theater on the ragged edge of town. I don't remember if his father was dead, if he'd abandoned the family, or if divorce was the reason for his absence. Kim never talked about his dad. I never spoke of my parents, both of whom had died by the time I was 7. When and how we met, I no longer recall. Mutual losses might have drawn us together in a town where the nuclear family was the standard. Neither of us fit in. Kim was an indifferent student, dreamy and continually urged to concentrate on his studies. I was an unimpressive scholar who only did well in English class. As misfits, we were both bullied by our smug and sadistic classmates, the sons and daughters of normal families. It wasn't long before Kim and I were thick as thieves. All through 7th and 8th grades, he came home with me for lunch. My house was right around the corner from the junior high school, so it was easy to dash over, eat, then dash back for our afternoon classes. Aunt Marion plied us with pork chops, baked potatoes, braised asparagus, and glasses of milk. Ice cream for dessert in the warmer months, freshly baked chocolate cupcakes with vanilla icing in the colder ones. Valentine's Day meant a heart-shaped cake with red frosting, Halloween brought us bright orange pumpkin and dark molasses cat cookies. During the holidays, we devoured a forest of Christmas trees and a galaxy of stars. Marion always offered seconds. Kim always accepted. Kim ate with us so often that his mother asked him to see if my aunt would let me come over for dinner some evening as a way of saying thank you. Marion thought that was fine and on the chosen night drove me to Kim's house. I'd only been there once when we stopped to pick Kim up for the Easter sunrise service at Memorial Auditorium, and I'd never been inside. I'd give a great deal to forget that evening. Nothing bad or untoward happened. Lively and loud, Bonnie bustled between the stove and the kitchen table, singing along to the radio as she served up Kraft macaroni and cheese, bologna sandwiches on white bread with bright yellow mustard, and Orida fries. She clearly adored Kim, who was overjoyed to have me there. After dinner, we played a rousing game of Battleship and ate the cheesecake Marion had baked for me to take along. "Don't show up with your hands hanging," was her motto. It was a perfectly ordinary evening in rural Minnesota circa 1975. Then why, on my way home when Marion asked me how things had gone, did I burst into tears? I couldn't explain it to her then. I was swamped with the immensity of the new experience. Thinking about it now, well, now it's clearer. I was a sheltered child. As a voracious reader, I knew a great deal about the world, well, in theory. Reality was a different matter. I read about poverty, but never experienced it firsthand until that night. I was shocked by the ramshackle house, the missing window panes patched with cardboard, the threadbare carpet, the misshapen couch and mismatched chairs, the smell of garbage we tasted with every bite. Oh, please understand me. I wasn't judging them. No, something else happened that evening. I was forcibly made to realize exactly why Kim always asked to have lunch with me and my aunt. He was hungry, hungry in a way I'd never known. He was grateful for a pair of my old gloves because Bonnie couldn't afford to buy him a pair of his own. For a moment, I saw him the way the rest of the world did, and torn between scorn and pity, I felt ashamed and appalled. That was how others looked at him, not me. How had their horrible thoughts invaded my head? How could I think of him like that? He was my friend. I glimpsed the inhumanity of a system that rewarded one boy and punished another for no explicable reason. The struggle to make sense of these conflicting emotions overwhelmed me, and I sobbed all the way home. I'll never forget that anguish. It remains alive in me, dormant but ever present, like a virus. Our friendship might have survived dinner at Kim's house if circumstances hadn't completely destroyed it. Shortly after that evening, Bonnie met and married Will Bober, an insurance salesman. Marion heard all about him through the grapevine. Short and stocky, with a ready smile and easy manner, Wilt was the nicest guy in the world if he was trying to sign you up for a policy. Otherwise, watch out. A moody World War II vet who spent most of his time and money at the A&T Tap. Wilt had a jealous streak and a violent temper. "It doesn't bode well if you ask me," my aunt said. "What she sees in him, I don't know." Marion wasn't alone. No one in town did. Well, no one but Bonnie. She and Kim moved to Windham, a good 30 miles away where Bober ran his business. Kim went to high school there. I never saw him again, well, except once. It was a humid afternoon in mid-July. I was sitting on the front porch reading The Murderer is a Fox, I looked up from my book as an old beater of a car blaring Alice Cooper drew up to the curb in a cloud of blue exhaust. School's out, cut off abruptly, and a lanky figure climbed out and ambled toward the house. I met him on the lawn. We'd both have been 18 at the time. My birthday was in February. Kim's was in June. He said he'd been working as a roofer for his stepfather, repairing some of the properties Wilt Bober owned in and around Wyndham. His light blonde hair was cut brutally short and burned white by the sun, and his arms, face, and neck were tanned a deep brown. "You know what the old bastard's paying me? Room and board." "Well, that's all?" "Well, and gas money, but yeah, that's it." He spat on the grass. "Soon as I can, I'm getting out of there, out of his house." We talked a while longer. I didn't mention I was going off to college in September. My future seemed assured. I was going to be an artist and a theater major, but what did he have to look forward to? Wrecking his knees, shingling roofs. Finally, he said he should be going. He had errands to run for the job. I walked him to his car. A half-empty pack of Marlboros rested on the dashboard. Kim smoked. He offered me a cigarette, and when I refused, lit one up for himself. He turned the key in the ignition. The car radio blared "Heartache Tonight" by the Eagles. He adjusted the volume. "Hey, see you around," he said, shifting into first gear. "Hey, yeah, see ya." It was my sophomore year in college, early December, worn to a frazzle by tech rehearsals for the fall play. I slept in and missed my morning class, Introduction to Anthropology, my one mandatory science class. Well, I took it because it didn't require math or any kind of technical knowledge. I enjoyed the class when I was there, but I wasn't there very often, thanks to the pressing demands of college theater. In my dorm room, I was having my first bleary-eyed smoke of the morning. Yes, I'd picked up the habit along the way. I was washing down my breakfast, a Pearson's chocolate-covered salted nut roll from the vending machine down the hall, with warm Coca-Cola when Aunt Marion called. "Oh, you'll never guess who was just here," she said.
"Well, who?"
"Kim."
"Kim? Kim who?"
"Kim Luke, you know, your old friend. He's in town to see his mother."
"Oh, I thought she lived in Wyndham."
"Well, she did," Marion said. "But her health isn't too good these days, so she and Kim's stepfather moved back to town so they could be closer to her doctor. I hear they bought a very ritzy split level in Homewood Hills. Just shows what you can do with a little money."
"So what's Kim up to these days?"
"He's in the Navy. He's here on, what do they call it?"
"Shore leave?"
"Yeah, that's it," she laughed. "The Navy, can you believe it?"
"Well, it's better than prison."
"That's where I was afraid he'd end up. Life didn't deal him a very good hand. The Navy's really straightened him out. Who knows what would have happened otherwise?"
Ever the optimist, Marion added, "I'm glad for him. All he needed was someone to believe in him."
"How long was he there?"
"Oh, about an hour. I made him lunch, and we talked, just like the old days."
"You know what he did while I was cooking?"
"Shoveled the sidewalk."
"Did he ask about me?"
"Oh, sure."
"Did you tell him I'm going to Hamlin?"
"I did. I told him all about the play you're in, Hedda Gobbler?"
"Gabbler," I said. "Hedda Gabbler."
"I told him about that and how much you like your teachers. He said that was great. If one of you made it to college, of course it would be you."
She hesitated.
"I don't know if I should mention this,
but
I wondered if he isn't in some kind of trouble."
"Oh, why's that?" I said.
"Just before he left, he said, 'Don't think badly of me. I told him I could never think badly of him. I said I'd known him since he was a boy and knew he had a good heart. Then I gave him a kiss and some fresh donuts and watched him walk down McMillan.
She sighed as if she could still see his tall, dark figure striding alone through the whiteness of winter.
You were such good friends for a while. Isn't it odd how things change?
After the call, I thought about Kim. Marion was right. We had been friends, but now I had other friends and other obligations, such as finding a dozen more props. I was the property master as well as George Tessman. Hedda's husband, it was a small department and it kept us hopping. I went to the theater building and forgot about Kim for a while.
Marion called me again after supper. I was due at theater for tech.
You'll never guess what happened, she said.
With what?
With Kim. Who else?
Marion breathlessly related the string of events. At some point after he left Marion, Kim went to the sheriff's office. He'd told Sheriff Peterson that he'd visited his mother that day. Just as Kim was getting ready to leave, his stepfather, full of rage and whiskey, burst into the living room, raving that Bonnie had been having an affair with one of his buddies. Then Wilt flung her against a wall and whipped out a pistol. Bonnie was terrified. Kim charged Wilt, and the gun went off in the struggle. Wilt took a bullet in the chest and bled to death on the new living room rug. Kim assumed full responsibility for what had happened, said it was an accident, and pled self-defense. Something bothered Marion. A devoted mystery reader, she was continually applying what she'd learned from Rex Stout and Ross McDonald to real-life crimes. When Kim said, "Don't think badly of me," does that mean he'd already killed his stepfather?
Well, that would be the logical assumption. I glanced at the clock. Oh, it's almost six, and I have to.
But if that's the case, why did he visit me before he went to the authorities? Was he asking me to forgive him for what he'd done? Or was he asking me to forgive something he was about to do? If he was, then it was premeditated murder, and I just can't believe Kim would do that. What do you think?
Marion, I hate to cut you short, but I have got rehearsal, and we open tomorrow night, and there's still a ton of work to do.
Oh, goodness, she said. Don't let me keep you. But I still don't think Kim could kill anyone in cold blood.
I hurried from the dorm, through the frigid darkness to the theater building. Gluing on 19th century sideburns with spirit gum, I had to agree with Marion. Kim would never kill anyone. Still, what did I really know? For a couple of years, we'd been friends, and then we weren't. I had no idea who he was or what he was capable of, especially if his safety or his mother's safety was threatened. Kim? A murderer? It seemed impossible. But Wilt Bober was dead, and someone had shot him. All I could think of was the last line of Hedda Gabler. People don't do such things. I spent the holidays at home that year. Marion put up a Christmas tree and baked cookies. On the 31st, we stayed up till midnight toasting the new year with ginger ale. My plan was to leave around noon on Sunday, so I'd arrive in St. Paul while it was still daylight. I took one last drive around the lake the night before, something I'd done 1,000 times. Dreaming of the world beyond this backwater, listening to Joe Jackson and Leon Redbone on the car's cassette player. I'd put on mile after mile, night after night after night. I decided I'd stop by Michael's restaurant to see if anyone I knew was there. No one was in the Vincenzia dining room, so I went downstairs to the Sicily Lounge. It was as empty as a snow-covered cornfield. I had a tequila sunrise and decided to head home. First, though, I used the men's room. I opened the door and heard voices. The men's room had a small foyer with a vintage travel poster advertising the charms of Sorrento hanging above the table bearing a bowl of purple potpourri. The facilities were around the corner. Two men were standing at the urinals, Sheriff Peterson and Dr. Graham, who served as the county coroner. I stopped when I heard that they were discussing something and, unnoticed, quietly retreated to the foyer.
Well, you know, that's what I don't understand, the doctor was saying. Wilt drank like a fish. We all knew it. His corpse reeked of whiskey,
but there wasn't a drop of alcohol in his bloodstream, and if he'd been fighting, there wasn't a bruise on him. He flushed the urinal and washed his hands under the chrome dolphin-shaped tap. You'd almost think Kim shot him, then poured a bottle of whiskey over him.
Or Bonnie, the sheriff said. Kim might be covering for her.
They were silent for a time. Dr. Graham yanked on the cloth roller towel and dried his hands. The sheriff took his place at the sink. I heard the crackle of cellophane and the scratch and flare of a match. The doctor had lit a cigar.
So?
Sheriff Peterson sounded reluctant.
Well, we could press the matter, but I'm not sure what good it would do. Wilt made Bonnie's life hell.
Well, he made everyone's life hell.
Some folks would say he got what he deserved exactly. I tend to agree with him. We'll go through the motions, then. Well, we'll forget about it.
There's only one good thing about this whole damn mess, as far as I can see.
And what's that?
I took a silent step toward them to make sure I heard whatever the sheriff said next.
Well, Bonnie's coming into a heck of a lot of money. Old Wilt, that nasty SOB. But he insured himself to the hilt. When there's all that property he owned around Wyndham, too, Wilt was loaded.
In more ways than one, Graham said.
The sheriff started for the door. Speaking of loaded, I think an Irish coffee or two's in order before I hit the trail.
That was my exit line.
I silently left the men's room and was studying a mural of the Italian countryside as the two men, oblivious to my presence, descended the stairs to the Sicily lounge. I never told my aunt about their conversation. If Dr. Graham and Sheriff Peterson were willing to let the matter of Wilt Bober's death slide, shouldn't I do the same? I felt I owed Kim something, but what? I asked myself. My answer? Well, the benefit of the doubt. Isn't it odd, my aunt said, how things change?
It's exceedingly odd.
More than 40 years have passed since Will Bober was shot and killed. I'm nearing retirement. Marion's been gone for 7 years now, and Kim is dead, too. I was thinking about him the other day, which prompted an internet search. I found his obituary on the North Dakota Sun's website. I was shocked to learn he died around the turn of the year. The facts were briefly stated. Kim Lucht, 62, of Bismarck, married, divorced, survived by a daughter and a granddaughter. I was tempted to call it a life without incident, but there's no such thing. Life is all incident. When I called to offer my condolences, his daughter Amber told me what had happened after Bober's death. Kim was tried for justifiable homicide. The judge was lenient. Kim received a suspended sentence and served no time in jail. The Navy was, well, less understanding, and Kim was quietly mustered out. Bonnie came into a ton of money, just as Sheriff Peterson had predicted, but she didn't enjoy it very long. 3 months after the insurance payout, a group of stoned Mankato State students in a VW bus broadsided Bonnie's brand-new bright red Pacer. The kid suffered some cuts and scrapes. Bonnie died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Her money went to Kim. Cut free of the discipline and structure the Navy provided, Kim burned through a substantial nest egg on drugs and booze and a short-lived marriage with Amber's mother, a young salesman at Joanne Fabrics in the mall. He cleaned up after the birth of his granddaughter.
At the time of his death, he was working in a Goodwill store when he wasn't driving a bus for the local school system. His daughter had a degree in social work from University of North Dakota. She'd moved back to the Bismarck area and counseled justice-involved youth. After years of no communication, she'd reached out to her father. "Well, I hardly saw him when I was a kid," Amber told me. "It was a pretty bad breakup with my mom. They were both heavy into chemicals, if you know what I mean. Over the last couple of years, we'd come to understand each other a little. I liked him. He wasn't a bad guy, but so sad. I've never seen a person as disappointed as he was, as if he'd been expecting something that never came." I asked her a stupid question. "Was he happy?" "Well, I think he found some kind of peace," Amber said. "He loved being a grandfather, I know that. He didn't talk much about himself or the past." "Sometimes I think the past is all I talk about." "Well, then you've got good memories. Dad didn't have too many of those." She paused. "He liked your mother. He talked about her. Was it your mother?" "No, my aunt. People always thought she was my mother. It was a common mistake." "I wasn't sure, but I know he liked her. She was kind to him." "She was a kind person." I heard a faint chiming in the background. "Somebody's at the door," she said. "Thanks for calling. It means a lot to me. It really does. If you ever get out this way, I'd love to meet you. We could talk some more about Dad." "You know, that'd be great." "Hold your horses," she cried out to the invisible caller, then returned to me. "Thanks again. See you around, I hope." "See ya," I said, and hung up. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Keith Tyler here saying thanks again for joining me, and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.